It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, we're joined here today with two people from the Black Rose Anarchist Federation. We're going to be talking about a position paper they've recently published called Below and Beyond Trump, as well as some of the things that they're currently organizing around. But real quick, can you two introduce yourselves?
So my name's Enrique, and I'm a member of Black Rose Anarchist Federation. I'm based in Durham.
And my name's Adam, and I'm also a member of Black Rose Anarchist Federation based out of Miami.
So real quick, what is the Black Rose Anarchist Federation and where did it come from?
So Black Rose is an anarchist political organization. It's based here in the U.S. We have over a dozen locals spread throughout the country. The organization itself was founded in, I think, late 2013. Kind of came out of a series of discussions that took place between local, regional and national anarchist political organizations at that time. So Miami Autonomy and Solidarity, Northeastern Federation of Anarchist Communists, what at that time was Common Struggle, and others at what was called the Class Struggle Conference, which was this sort of closed gathering that was held, I think, four times in different cities over the course of years. And out of those conversations that took place at the Class Struggle Anarchist Conference, it kind of led to this separate process of merging members from these different organizations locally, regionally, and nationally into what ultimately became Black Rose.
Well, I'm just curious, real quick, if you can talk about currently, what are some of the things that people are working on within the Federation in terms of organizing and mobilizing? We're going to talk specifically about what happened in L.A., and people pushing back against ICE raids later in the program, but just kind of in the broad strokes, if you can talk about what Black Rose chapters are doing right now.
Yeah, so the organization over the years has sort of started to divide our social movement activity into four different sectors. So labor organizing, territorial organizing, which kind of encompasses housing, community organizing, environmental struggles, anti-criminalization, which revolves around sort of prisons, immigration, policing, and then international relations. So when it comes to labor, we have folks both in the IWW and in business unions who are working in K through 12 education. So, I'm a high school teacher that's organizing. We have folks in the service industry. Some of the folks who listen to the podcast, probably following what's going on in the Burgerville campaign. We have members involved in that. Sex work, construction, healthcare, and others. We have folks involved in the territorial sector in building popular assemblies. So we have the Asamblea Popular del Pueblo in East Boston. Other folks involved in anti-gentrification in New York, various people involved in the General Defense Committee in different cities, other folks involved in tenants unions, and then we've got around prisons and so on, we got folks in IWOC, the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, and we've been involved in different immigration struggles in Austin, Portland, Boston, LA, and then around the international work, we have folks that are sort of building relationships with anarchist political organizations and struggles in South America, in the Caribbean, parts of the Middle East, in Europe.
And Burgerville just announced today that they added yet another store, I believe, to their campaign.
Yeah, we did see that. Continues to expand, grow, develop, and it's pretty inspiring.
Awesome. So we're going to turn now to the position paper discussion document, however the kids say it nowadays. It's entitled...
They're all the kids are talking about it.
Below and beyond Trump. It's kind of a year-end position piece. I encourage people to read it. It is on It's Going Down and, of course, on the Black Rose Anarchist Federation blog. But in it, you lay out a critique of both the current economic and political reality in the U.S. as well as the shortcomings as the Federation sees it in terms of the wider left. But let's start off with the first part. You start off by saying that the U.S. ruling class is in a crisis. Now, I think a lot of people will look at the situation and say, like, well, the state looks really scary and also very strong. So how can it be in a crisis? So how would you explain that this is so?
Sure. So first thing that I want to start off with around the position statement is that this is actually something that we've been working on, a discussion that's been taking place within Black for a couple years, actually, about how to collectively analyze the political terrain of the U.S. and from that develop our strategy as revolutionaries. So, you know, it's been a long time process. So as far as explaining that crisis at the top, you know, how we characterize it is that it's fundamentally a crisis at the top. It's one of political legitimacy for the state, right? And there's three main factors that we see driving that, right? So one is the decline of U.S. power, right, in the international arena, economic power, political power for the U.S. to get its way. That's been in definite decline, right? Next, we have climate change, right? Everybody can see it's happening. But what are the solutions, right? Nothing but very tepid, you know, and again, the ruling class and like the elite are very divided without a clear response to that, right? And it's really hard to deny it when their mansions are on fire in LA, you know, as of within the last month or so. Three is the internal dissent within the U.S. and cracks raised in the kind of political mythology that the U.S. rests upon, right? And especially those were driven by around race and class by the Occupy movement, right? And Black Lives Matter, right? And all this, underlying all this, right, is feeding into it is just the ravages of 40 years of neoliberalism, right? Attacks on wages, unions, deindustrialization, et cetera, right? So what we see is on each of these issues, and, you know, there's a lot of other factors. In fact, the paper, it just condenses a lot of stuff into it. So it's kind of hard to easily summarize everything. So we're just trying to give, you know, quick nutshell explanations, right? Mm-hmm. But for each of these things, there's no real ruling class, right? In fact, there's exactly the opposite. A lot of divisions, different factions are pulling in different directions. And so without any far-sighted elements that can take create enough of a unified block of sorts from the top to create a consensus, and they can't you know, keep out the marginal elements of the far right, the left, that are basically coming from outside of the what's been the traditional kind of political center of the U.S., right? And that's all that is driving that crisis, right? Crisis of legitimacy and of just where the hell is going, right? But one thing that we do think is that we can't underestimate the resiliency of the state and elite institutions like the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, to, you know, reconstitute themselves, right? If capitalism wasn't flexible and adaptable as a system, it wouldn't have managed to survive so long, obviously, right? Okay.
So just on that point, you feel that that it's basically the end result of, as you said, 40 years of neoliberalism that have caused the crisis of legitimacy, not so much in Trump himself, which has just, you know, as Dave Chappelle said, you know, I think everybody can agree that the shit really sucks. But is it both of those things? Or is it?
Well, Trump is, you know, I think it's easy to see, just like when Bush came to power, you know, here's everything wrong. But as soon as Obama replaced him, we see many of those things that were, you know, fucked up under Bush continuing and even expanding. Right. So it's not the particular rulers that are driving these, or, you know, particular person or figure or party that's in power that's driving these. But, you know, these larger systemic structural problems and crises, right? So in many ways, Trump is symptom of all these things, right? There's no way Trump wouldn't have gotten in to win an election if there wasn't some major schisms and dysfunctions within, you know, both of the Democrats and the Republicans, obviously, right? But as much as he's a symptom, right, he's also exacerbating a lot of these problems, right, through all his insanity, right? So I think it's also driving, furthering all these existing cracks and fissures within the system.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out that, you know, no matter what Republican or Democrat would have been put in, I mean, they probably would have done some version of the same thing that Trump is doing now. They probably would have pushed some sort of tax cut to the wealthy, although maybe not as much as Trump did.
Sure.
You know, they would have continued what Obama was pushing, just mass deportations and building up that apparatus. But I mean, and, you know, also this like very real drive for war. And you could argue that if Hillary was in office, we might have already be fighting a ground war against, you know, Russia or some other country.
Iran.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
They would have done it with a smile.
Right. We wouldn't have had the tweets though, you know. Come on. No one would have been eating cheeseburgers in bed, so at least we could all sleep at night. We'd all be eating brunch, as all the Women's March signs say.
Without
indeed.
So you go on to write in that section that the center can't hold. So what do you mean by this? What does it mean that the center can't hold?
I mean, in some ways, it's sort of an outgrowth of the crisis at the top that Adam was talking about. And we've sort of seen the kind of unraveling of the sort of legitimacy of the sort of traditional centers of power, particularly in the wake of the economic crisis, where these folks just don't have a clear path out of the mess that we're in. And so we're seeing increasing political polarization as a result. So you have folks running further to the right. You have folks running further to the left, to some extent to our benefit, right? But that the ideological glue that tends to hold us together is starting to be done. And we're starting to see all the kind of cracks open up a little bit more. And so, you know, the whole kind of short-lived post-racial honeymoon period under Obama, came crashing down once we started this, you know, Black Lives Matter drew more attention to sort of ongoing murder of Black folks by police, mass incarceration. You know, we saw state violence against indigenous water protectors. We've seen the hollowing out of, you know, what little Black wealth did exist as a result of the crisis, unprecedented deportations of immigrants that you mentioned under Obama. And this is all kind of kicking the legs out from all the kind of key pillars of American mythology. So, you know, American dream, this idea of social mobility, and, well, if we just work hard enough, we'll all get to that land of milk and honey. You know, we have more and more people waiting for the bus to arrive on that one, right? And there's American exceptionalism, another kind of key pillar of the American mythological narrative. I think since the Iraq War, Afghanistan, expanding drone strikes, I mean, a lot of that is sort of the veil has been lifted. And increasing sort of precarity in the economy is only furthering or deepening that kind of crisis of legitimacy to get us to the point where we're at.
Yeah, and just expanding on that, there was a report that came out just today. Enrique and I heard it on NPR while we were preparing for this podcast, that within a decade, 50% of American workers are expected to be freelancers or independent contractors of some sort. So, I mean, to me, that fact just kind of crystallizes the, as far as on the economic level, you know, the level of precarity. I mean, that means if you're a freelancer, then, you know, you're not going to be able to buy healthcare through your job, right? But further, I think for me, becoming politically active in the 90s, right, in the late 90s, there was a sort of consensus of in American politics around, it's exceptionalism, right? And any movements that sought to challenge that were essentially just looked at as kind of crazy, right? But the level of shift in the discourse, right, that protest is not only normal, but it's something expected, and that there are really, you know, this widespread acceptance that there are really serious issues that need some kind of change. I mean, even at the top, people admit that. Even the Republicans during Occupy said, let's cross off capitalism from a list of, you know, word talking points, because that word is so far down in the mud at the moment, right? So just the fact that the Republicans would even do that at any point, right, it just shows you what kind of tremendous, you know, shift that's occurred on the level of ideas within the U.S.
Right. You mentioned 50% of people becoming freelancers. I mean, there's also other reports that have come out of different prestigious universities saying, in the next 15 years, about 40% of jobs that exist now will be somehow either replaced or impacted by automation. But yeah, I mean, and I'm curious with that in mind, I mean, this idea that the center can't hold, you know, what do you think some of the tasks of anarchists are? Because, you know, in pointing that out, it's, in many ways, it's not a very nice or like happy thing to point out. I mean, you're literally pointing at the future and saying, like, look, shit's very bad. And, you know, we need a completely different, you know, way of life to, you know, answer this. Not like, you know, hey, some progressive vision of like, you know, we'll slowly march through the institutions and get to the promised land. I mean, I'm just curious, you know, what do you think some of the tasks of anarchists are currently right now with that in mind?
Well, in some ways, you know, I'm not, I don't normally quote Milton Friedman, but I think it was Friedman who said something along the lines that, you know, in our moment of opportunity, and it just depends on what ideas are around at the time and which ones take hold. And as I mentioned before, this moment where the center can't hold and the political environment is being polarized, people are running to the left, people are running to the right for alternatives to sort of traditional centers of power, that creates an opportunity for us to start to widen the and to, I think, develop our forces in this moment. So, you know, we're also seeing a rise in the far right, but at the same time, I think, you know, we're different forces on the left building out from the current crisis in a lot of positive ways as well.
Yeah, I mean, you have 50% of millennials saying that they're opposed to capitalism. I mean, you know, I mean, I have obviously some issues with the DSA, but I mean, you know, they have like, what, 30,000 members. I mean, the anarchist movement is especially vibrant. It seems like all sectors of kind of organizing and work that anarchists are engaging in, from pipelines to labor struggles, is on the up. So there's a lot going on. I mean, you know, we talk about the rise of the far right a lot, obviously, but I mean, there's it seems that there's much more people that think that there's a problem with capitalism in the state than there are with, you know, immigrants or black people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, in coming out of, you know, Trump first coming into office, where every left group or project or, you know, what have you, just started receiving a flood of inquiries, people, their meetings. I heard reports of meetings going from 10 to 100 people within a matter of a month, right? So it again, it's, you know, like Enrique was saying, it's a moment, right? But the question is, where are we going to take it, right? Those hundreds will show up, right? But if those people easily be swayed that, hey, you know, the next Democrat who comes along and promises this and that is going to be the solution, well, then they're going to leave all the meetings and doors or handing out flyers for, you know, the next Bernie Sanders, right? So it's a question of how can we take and push to directions that, you know, advance our ideas of, you know, building power from below, you know, social movements that are combative, right? And also combating these narratives that, you know, we need to polls, we need to get serious and take electoral power. And also just, you know, criticizing a huge weight on the, and I know we had this set for later questions, right? But a huge weight that weighs down on the left and the radical left and the anarchists, right, is just the weight of the, we'll call the institutional left, right, of NGOs, unions, et cetera, and allied groups often connected to the Democratic Party that constantly are channeling any struggle that comes along or pops up, redirecting into like electoral or, you know, kind of lobbying directions, right, or just kind of stage managed protests from above, right? So how do we break their that lock that they've had, right? I mean, it's a challenge. I don't think we're coming saying that we have some, you know, ready-made answers and plans for it, but I mean, I think that that's really our task.
Yeah, and we're gonna get into that a little more later in the program. But I mean, also, like as you say, you know, the center can't hold. I mean, even if a Democrat does come into office, it's not like any of these problems are going to go away. So I think that, you know, one of the tasks of anarchists is to really look towards the next 10, 20, 30 years and know that all these different types of crises are coming and that, you know, we kind of need a longer vision than, you know, just the next 4 years under Trump or the next 8 years.
Absolutely.
But moving forward, in your discussion document, you then go on to talk about social movements, particularly currently in the U.S. You write, quote, movements are fractured and most seem to be moving towards some sort of type of retrenchment strategy in response to Trump. What do you mean by this? What do you mean, entrenchment strategy? And can you give us some examples of this?
Sure, definitely. So what we're seeing is overall many organizations, and this is very tied to what we were talking about, the institutional left, is a scaling back of organizing efforts, right? And more of a move away from let's organize and push for demands or raise demands into more of a permanent defensive position, right? A permanent defense mode, right? So some real easy examples, right, is as soon as Trump got elected, SEIU cut their budget for Fight for 15. And also segments of Black Lives Matter, the movement for Black Lives, that the platform that they adopted, it did have some positive expansive demands, but at the time, it had a clear move in a direction of policy. And then, I mean, obviously we have not seen there's been a decrease in street protests, right? So again, it's this. Under the Democrats, we have this idea that we have friends in power, and under Trump, then it simply becomes, let's just defend what we have and wait for the next Democrat to come into power. And so in a lot of ways, that institutional left is looking for a major disconnect and discrediting that went on under the a lot of those forces are looking to recalibrate, right, and push people towards winning local and regional offices. Right. And then that builds up into taking back the Congress in the midterms that are, you know, coming up. And then ultimately the presidency in 2020. And so obviously as anarchists, there's huge issues with this. And, you know, this kind of cycle, we're going to keep seeing this rinse, recycle and repeat. Right. I mean, on one hand, there is, and this was cited by folks in Black Lives Matter, there is a greater risk of repression under Trump. And we see that with the repression level against the J20 arrestees, right? But on the other hand, the opposition, the anger and opposition to Trump and the right is, you know, greater than ever, right? And so this is where the point that we discuss in the document around offensive struggles is that we see that as central, right? In an orientation towards retrenchment, permanent defensiveness, is we see that in this moment, people are really angry and we need to capitalize on that. And we should push that towards offensive struggle. And by that is, you know, just bold and offensive that put forward what we want, what people need, and moves beyond what's, you know, quote, politically acceptable. So examples that we saw in recent history, you know, that speak to this are the, you know, the slogan, disarm, defund, disband the police, right? I mean, that's actually a demand that movements, it wasn't just a handful of radicals pushing that on the sidelines, but actual communities just took that up and raised the question of how do we reduce the role of police and policing in our communities, right? I think that's a great example. And another arena is maybe just Medicare for all, maybe going beyond that, I would say, free healthcare, getting profits out of health, democratic community control around healthcare, right? I think maybe that might take some more thinking through, but those are some examples of how we can move from defensive, right, to offensive.
So in that section, you go on to state that the current mode of social struggles is, quote, militant reformism. Curious if you can just explain that point a little bit more.
Again, you know, keep in mind that a lot of these conversations were had under Obama. It's not to say that this trend isn't continuing and won't continue under Trump. But we saw this development, particularly during the Obama era. And basically what we're talking about, more or less sort of reformist political orientation that gets masked in militant tactics, rhetoric, and symbolism. It's particularly prevalent in the institutional left, we mentioned. So, you know, nonprofit industrial complex, business unions, and so on. And, you know, you can sort of see various examples of it. I mean, one you could point to are some of the student struggles that we saw on college campuses under Obama, where you had kind of sit-ins, walkouts, hunger strikes, and so on. But sort of pushing more reformist demands, where you have, you know, we demand that the president of the university read a public letter stating that he uses white privilege, and, you know, on through what amount to sort of expanding diversity and inclusion within the university system. That's not so much about transforming the nature and structure of the institution, but more about how do we, you know, set the table for more seats in a burning house, right? So you can sort of contrast the kind of militant reformist nature, say, student struggles or other struggles in the United States with, you know, student struggles in South Africa, where you have folks tearing down statues, renaming buildings, street fights with the cops, built around demands for free tuition and more popular control that are building popular power on the ground, right? Whereas what we tend to see in some of these campuses in particular are kind of fleeting struggles that kind of come and go, although we have seen organizations and important developments that come out of these struggles. There is this kind of tendency toward a militant reformism. Again, we tend to see this more Democrats just thinking that, oh, well, we have quote-unquote friends in high places, or now we've got allies in power that if we push just hard enough, they'll, you know, carry the ball line for us and we'll live happily ever after. And so if you look back even at the Obama campaign in 2008, where you had groups like Progressives for Obama and others trying to sort of breathe new life into this narrative around FDR and the New Deal and how we need to just sort of pressure Obama to create a new deal. That's that new, right? Create the new deal. But what was missing from that historical analogy is the credible threat of a communist party, a militant labor movement, and so on that allows you to kick the door down and not, create this narrative around, well, we just need to push on this open door because our buddy's in there, and trust me, he's more progressive than he actually makes himself out to be, right?
The other thing I would add on to that is it's not that we think militant reformism will disappear. Definitely we see the stronger pull in this period seems to be electoralism, right? But that if there is a shift, right, say the Democrats get majorities in the Congresses after the midterms, that actually might change things. And we could see this phenomenon of militant reformism come back, right? Perhaps with a vengeance. Who knows? We'll have to see.
Yeah, I mean, our thing has always been, it seems like mentally the real big hurdle that people need to overcome is this idea that, like, you know, the reason that, like, for instance, somebody would, like, do something like go out and block a freeway after somebody gets killed by the police is that in the back of people's minds, the idea is that someone will listen to us if, you know, if we do X, Y, Z, even if it's just, you know, this intense, crazy shit, like, you know, burning down a city or, you know, blocking freeways or something, that something will come out of that. And it seems more and more that the state is not interested in acquiescing to to anything like that. I mean, even under Obama, you know, we saw things like the institution of body cameras, which just went on to, you know, do nothing or perhaps even like do more damage or something like that. So, I mean, but that seems to be like a real big thing that, that we're interested in kind of pushing is just this idea that like we need to kind of like kind of envision struggle. You know, like the reason we're doing this is to increase our own power and to put forward our own interests to like solve our own problems, not just to do something just because somebody hopefully will listen, because most of the time they're not. Or even if they do kind of, you know, at least address certain concerns, you know, they do so in a way that takes our own energy away.
Right. There's a sort of process that, you know, Adam and I have talked about before, of the sort of three D's that you end up seeing in these moments where there's a sort of effort to kind of demobilize, defang, and develop dependency relationships with the state. And Obama was a master implementing those, particularly with the anti-war movement.
Remember people seeing people with shirts on that had Obama's name with a peace sign in it. It's just like, what are you talking about? But going back to the piece, you correctly point out that many groups are attempting to channel energy back into the ballot box. I mean, everybody that's paying attention obviously noticed the women's marches this this weekend, and a huge part of that was to get people to run for office, get people to vote. So what are your thoughts on as far as how to subvert attack and kind of get beyond this predictable phenomenon? Because 2018, for many people, will be all about the midterm elections.
I mean, ultimately, I think the onus is to demonstrate both in theory and practice a viable alternative to electoral politics, whether it comes in the form of, you know, liberal reformism, or it comes with a left flavor to it, right? And we have to sort of push beyond this endless cycle of symbolic actions from the institutional left, which are kind of aimed at channeling their discontent into sort of lukewarm reforms. And it's, like I said, on us to put forward a compelling vision and strategy to get us there. And so beyond that, I would say we also do need to make a concern, particularly as anarchists, to delegitimize electoralism as a mode of struggle. And we can sort of draw on the wealth of both historical and contemporary examples of the just complete failure of electoralism, whether it's, you know, Syriza as a more contemporary example in Greece, or the Social Democratic Party in Germany. I mean, we have a sort of endless list of groups that have taken state power either by bullet and come in riding this wave of high hopes that folks on the left tend to take the pom-poms out for. And then when things go sour, tend to put them in their cubbyhole. And I think at a certain point, you know, we have to sort of come to terms with the fact that this isn't just a trap, as Kali Akuno from Cooperation Jackson has mentioned, that this is an electoral trap, period. This is not, well, we need to learn the lessons of this or that electoral struggle. And it's not a question of, I think there's oftentimes the sort of stock response to anarchists is that, oh, well, you just want to sort of ignore or sidestep the state. But I would argue it's because we take the state very seriously, and we've seen this pattern, over and over and over again, that we're not looking to sort of take a dive into the quicksand.
Yeah. And I would just, expand on it that I think it's important, to recognize that this push exists on the left towards electoralism, right? And I think it's mistaken on our part as anarchists to fall back on a sort of triumphalist narrative, right? You know, reformism and party politics are dead, right? They're discredited, right? No one believes in that anymore. Because the reality is that while some aspects are in tatters, on the other hand, other aspects are strengthening, right? So, you know, on one hand, you see the push from the Democratic-aligned NGOs, you know, your labor council, your usual suspects of the institutional left, right? Side is naturally hitting some huge bumps coming out of the 2016 elections and the disillusionment with the Democrats. But the strategy still seems to be, let's get people excited about races, and this is going to set the stage for the larger elections down the road. the midterms, and then ultimately the presidency, right? And then conveniently, that overlaps with a lot of the rhetoric that we're seeing coming out of different radicals, right? Even some segment of anarchists are embracing, this idea that, well, we reject national elections, but city councils, those are okay, you know, because they're magically different from all the other dynamics of elections, right? But on the other hand, on the left, there's a different story. From our analysis, our take is that this began post-Occupy. First, you see the election of Kushama Sawant in Seattle. And then in the attempts in other cities by left groups to push similar campaigns, right, for local offices, right? And then, of course, it's only grown post-Bernie Sanders, right? And now with other socialists winning local level office, that there was a whole wave of people who, especially from the DSA, pushed their narrative that, you know, we can protest till the cows come home. But if we want to make real change, then we need to build, take real political power through the state, right?
Just sort of building off the idea that to be able to demonstrate a viable alternative, I think part of that does speak to the need for developing anarchist political organization as carving out that alternative plank to electoral politics. But more importantly, I think making a long-term commitment to organizing where we live, work, play, and pray to start to build out organs of popular power, you know, and looking at and developing projects like this one, right? The It's Going Down podcast, wink, little plug, Submedia and others to start to sort of build out a communications infrastructure for the broader anarchist movement to start to advance our politics, our vision, the way out of the mess.
You know, not to pick at this too much, but, you know, you brought up, instead of electoralism, building up anarchist political organs. You know, one thing I've heard from a lot of people over the years is that in the United States specifically, you know, what's needed is not so much capital A anarchist groups, but like, you know, anarchist politics. So like spreading those practices and just ways of organizing is more important than anarchist groups that go around, you know, signing people up and flying the red and black flag. So I'm just curious, you know, why is it important that a group like Black Rose exists and has those politics? When you say, like, build an anarchist political structure, like, why is that important in your opinion?
Well, I mean, I think there's a number of reasons for it. I mean, I know I've personally run up against the limitations of a sort of localist orientation or a sort of diffuse network into anarchist politics. And at least in my experience, I've hit the ceiling very quickly with that. You know, I think a lot of the dynamics that we're facing in our communities, whether it's gentrification, displacement, precarity, and so on, these are global phenomenons that I think require a scaling up and pulling resources together to pose a meaningful and pushback to some of those dynamics. More specifically, I think, you know, political organizations, and we draw a lot of inspiration and influence from anarchist political organizations in South America, South Africa, and other places, that it's sort of allows for developing new militants, supporting and retaining more experienced organizers. It can also serve as a sort of historical memory of struggle. So, you know, in our organization, we have, you know, newer militants who are in their 20s to in the Love and Rage Anarchist Federation in the 90s, others who were part of the Chicano Moratorium Movement, some are in their 60s and 70s. And, you know, it gives us a political home to kind of step back into and reflect on those struggles, compare them to historical struggles, to analyze and reflect on the current moment, pull our resources to expand our reach in terms of propaganda to advance our politics, and allows us to sort of analyze and strategize collectively to advance struggle beyond these sort of fleeting local level collectives that tend to come and go. I think anarchist political organization is needed to kind of help us get through these periods of struggle that tend to go through peaks and troughs, and navigate those moments when, you know, struggle's on a downswing and upswing, to have a place to come to with like-minded comrades to strategize around where to intervene and what's happening in the current moment. So I know personally, you know, I can tell you a fair amount about what's happening in Durham, where I live. But I know that my understanding of what's happening here locally is enhanced by conversations that I can have with locals that we have around the country to kind of compare notes around how these similar dynamics are playing out in different localities and regions around the country.
Yeah, and I would just add on to that, you were saying earlier, you know, the goal should be to build politics, right? To spread those ideas, right? In my mind, the best way to do that is to be organized, right? To me, the goal of building anarchist political organization isn't to spread red and black flags throughout the world, right? Or in every demonstration, but the goal is to, you know, bring people together to strategize on how we can push forward movements, how we can put forward our ideas.
Yeah, I would just say that it's important that we're all organized, no matter what, you know, what kind of group or network or affinity group we're in. But just to kind of continue with what we were talking about in terms of electoralism, we're going to turn now to the DSA. In the piece, you mentioned the Democratic Socialists of America. In many ways, in our understanding, the electoral component of the DSA seems to be kind of taking on the same role that Bernie's campaign did. You know, one of the main things that Bernie did was energize people, get them excited, especially young people, low-wage workers, people of color, you know, were excited about Bernie's campaign and were, through it, kind of marched lock and step into the arms of Hillary Clinton. In many ways, the DSA seems to be doing that. I know in some instances that politicians locally are going to the DSA to kind of try out to get their endorsement. But I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on this reality as the DSA continues to grow?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that's a key question as well. So one thing that I think about is going back to the primaries when people were really feeling the burn, right? There was this quote from the radical journalist Arun Gupta, right? And he said that the left version of the get rich quick scheme is the get power quick scheme, right? And that's basically what we feel is driving this, right? And more people are looking towards, right, to get power quick, right, through elections. But we don't think we see it as a shortcut, ultimately, right? You know, the DSA is the largest left organization, at least in our lifetimes, right? And at least for some of us who try to keep our ears to the ground or, you know, the pulse of what's going on in the world, DSA is kind of like the leftist novella soap opera that we, you know, we're always kind of glued to, right? And not just, and that's not with any illusions. I mean, ultimately, we're, you know, happy that to see that lots of people are joining as their first kind of entry point into the left, right? When you keep that in mind. But also that it's an important barometer. Shouldn't be dismissive of those, but rather we need to be watching and engaging them critically. As DSA expands, there's also people who are part of it and who are sympathetic to anarchism, right? But ultimately, if we're not working to put forward our ideas, then we're not going to be able to move those people, right? And those people could be sympathetic to anarchism today, but then come midterm elections, they'll be the folks, you know, turning Democrat, right? Moral politics in the DSA, I think there's a couple things that we need to keep in mind, right? Or that's important to help us see the picture, right? Which is that within DSA, there's different tendencies, op caucuses, and they're all kind of vying for power and position and, you know, putting forward their platforms, et cetera, right? And some of them are more willing to run candidates on a Democratic Party ticket in local and state elections. Others, on the other hand, are more adamant that while we need to do that in the short term, maybe out of necessity, but that we need to push towards being independent of the Democrats, right? So those are some divisions, right? Others, though, place more emphasis on whether it's short-term or long-term, building towards an independent party of the left, right, or party of the 99%, or party of a new type. So while there's broad agreement on the need to engage in electoral struggles that we should still be critical of, there are differences on the, you know, the when and the who and the how and the details of the strategy, right? But in our kind of take on the situation, we see the midterm elections. That's going to be the interesting moment for the DSA, right? How will it relate to the Democrats? And also, will it heighten the tensions around these competing tendencies? For the folks who became involved in it or excited to be, you know, become involved in their first activist project, that's great. But are maybe critical and less enthusiastic about electoral strategies when they see if the group does move towards, you know, a more open embrace of the Democrats and electoralism, How will that change their ideas? We'll have to see, right? But we shouldn't discount our ability as anarchists to play a role in those conversations, right? So again, I know we mentioned it earlier, but just a necessity to push back on the reformism is dead and party politics are discredited. There's a huge interest right now in radical left politics. And from an anarchist perspective, that's both an opportunity and it's also a threat that other political tendencies are putting forward their visions, and they're very different from ours, right?
I do think it is important to look at the DSA not as a monolith, just given the size and the varying tendencies that are operating within it, start to tease out differences and divisions might lie. You know, it'll be interesting to see where things head after the midterms. But I think one of the conversations that we've had is there's a lot of sort of pomp and ceremony after the initial electoral victories. So Adam mentioned Virginia. But I think what gets less attention, what happens after they get in the driver and go for them. Because, like I said before, the pom-poms come out very quickly, and then they get in power and they have to govern, and the road starts getting bumpy. And then you start to see some of the cheerleaders recede into the background as things get difficult. Right. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens, you know, because I'm sure that they will get other victories here and there at a local level. But to the extent that they're able to carry forward the kind of vision that they have for electoral struggles, you know, I think they're going to hit a wall in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm. There's an article that we have called A Socialist on City Council, a look at the career of Kashama Sawant. It's just a critical look. Now that she's been in the driver's seat, as Enrique was saying, for a couple of years, we have some time to look and see how it actually played out, right? And when you take a look, it's actually there's a lot to be critical of, right? But I think with these new folks who've been recently elected, we need to watch. And I'm sure that these dynamics are going to play out over and over again. But we need to be there pointing that out. You know, it doesn't have to be a snarky way of doing it, but to be trying to point out the contradictions of, you know, raising the question: is this an effective strategy to build power? And our answer, of course, to that is no.
Or addressing all the problems that come with, you know, the capitalist industrial way of life currently right now that's hurtling is toward oblivion. Yeah, and I mean, you're so right in pointing out, you know, that you brought up the pom-poms. But I mean, that's the history of people on the left that have advocated taking state power forever, is they've run around and screamed about how they can start a state. And it's true, but doesn't mean that it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But just moving on, the later part of the statement, you then go on to state that we need to build autonomous social movement power, push offensive campaigns. Burgerville is shown as an example in the pictures, as well as pushing a libertarian socialist program or anarchist program. Can you dive a little more into this? What are some ideas about what this could look like? I think a lot of people would really kind of get hung up on that, on the term, you know, of the program. I mean, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can think about it as developing a sort of short to long term strategic plan that's aimed at building popular power again, where we sort of live, work, play, and pray, while keeping the horizon of libertarian socialism in focus. And so I mentioned, you know, part of that being building up or developing anarchist political organization for some of the reasons that I mentioned earlier. But in terms of aiming popular power, I mean, we're talking about, for example, forming and supporting militant tenant unions, continuing to struggle with things like IWOC, the General Defense Committee, formations like Solidarity and Defense, the IWW, participating in or initiating popular assemblies that could be at a local or regional level, forming rank and file committees within existing unions that are capable of acting outside the union leadership. We're talking about creating institutions or mechanisms to deal with conflict resolution and accountability at both the sort of, you know, individual and community level. Combative student unions, whether that's at K through 12 level or higher. You know, Adam mentioned the disempower, disarm, disband. I think the folks at For World Without Police are doing great work in terms of putting out an analysis and strategy for really taking taking abolition of the police seriously and how to move that short to long term. I think when it comes to offensive campaigns, you know, I would give a shout out to our comrades Romina and Bree, who wrote a piece called Breaking the Waves, challenging the liberal tendency within anarchist feminism. And if you take a look at the end of that piece, they start to lay out some concrete demands that can start to push feminist struggle forward. But I would argue, you know, beyond that, some that were mentioned earlier around sort of socializing healthcare, education, and housing as popular demands, demanding free community-based childcare, and vision for community and work around these institutions, so that we're not kind of constantly reacting to the moment, but advancing popular demands to build our forces. Yeah, I know that the program sounds maybe there's like some you know Trotskyist itch that people are getting or something like that when they hear that, but you know, talking more about short to long term trajectory of struggle.
Yeah, I mean that's what we're talking about. I mean, maybe we wouldn't use the term program, but I mean, yeah, I would agree that we need like a long term strategy. I think, you know, now is an interesting time as much as it is a scary time, because it makes as much sense to go out and organize as it does to, like, you know, maybe start like a community food program or some sort of kind of like resilience project, or, you know, a way to kind of like take your power outside of the system and try to start meeting your needs. I mean, but I think like that's kind of the, you know, kind of the task ahead of us, is to like kind of build up these mass vehicles for kind of class struggle. Let you know, the Burgerville campaign, and also to really take a side in, you know, fighting against this colonial white supremacist patriarchal system. I think like all the stuff IWOC is doing is really inspiring. Operation Push, I mean, there's some really great organizing that's happening right now. But at the same time, I think, you know, we also have to like start to address, you know, the ways in which this system is crumbling, and, you know, really start to kind of like build up our own alternatives. But just to kind of continue, someone asked, isn't this what the broader anarchist movement and all its various networks, organizations, everything, what needs to be improved, in other words, for the movement broadly as a whole to kind of catch up with some of these tactical proposals that you're talking about?
I mean, I think to some extent that is true, and there are, like we've talked about, a number of important struggles and organizations that are, you know, getting their fingernails dirty and doing a lot of the work that needs to be happening. I think, you know, even the stuff that we're mentioning is still in some ways in a kind of embryonic stage. And at least in our experience, there still is a sort of tendency to be somewhat insular with in the U.S., oriented toward appealing to and reproducing ourselves, or what a comrade of ours calls anarchist organizing anarchists. And so I think, at least my experience in talking to some other anarchists, there seems to be, and I appreciate you mentioning the need for this kind of, you know, 10 to 20 year visioning and strategic planning moving forward. But in my experience, I've seen a lot of aversion to long-term strategic thinking and planning within anarchist circles, that tends to kind of put us on this perpetual short-term defensive posture and sort of reacting to the stage that's set by the state and capital and white supremacy and heteropatriarchy. And we end up battling from a position of weakness on their terms. And I think in order to start to build up our forces, we need to start taking ourselves a bit more seriously in thinking about what does that 10-year trajectory look like and what's needed in the current moment. I mean, I would also say, you know, as much as we're talking about militant reformism or symbolic marches and all that on the liberal end of the spectrum, I mean, I think we could also argue to some extent that there's a anarchist side to the symbolic struggle coin, in that you can see sort of this taking the form of kind of fetishizing militancy for its own sake, regardless of the circumstances, or promoting a kind of revolutionary aesthetic with sort of in the absence of any kind of meaningful base to back that up. You know, I think we can get beyond some of that stuff as well. I mean, we without a doubt punch above our weight or have an influence well beyond our numbers. I think if we're being honest with ourselves, and we would recognize that we're still a relatively marginal force within the broader political landscape in the U.S. And that I think recognizing that marginality is a good starting place to start thinking through how we can have better impact moving forward. You know, I can start to look at what it would mean to kind of breathe new life into the mass anarchist orientation of the late 19th and early 20th century and start to rebuild that social base to really pose a credible threat to the state, capital, white supremacy, and heteropatriarchy in the long term.
You know, we signed on and helped kind of put together this Build the Base initiative on the week of January 20th. But the reason it's called that is because we really feel that the anarchist movement has to, you know, build a base of support within the wider working class and population of, you know, broke and poor people within the United States. Because, I mean, you know, now is the time that just so many people are just so fed up with both parties, with politics as usual, that just know how fucked up it is. I mean, every day if you turn on CNN or the other big networks, I mean, it's all liberal versus conservative. But, I mean, there's just so many more people that are more, much more in line with what we're thinking and what we're frustrated about, I think, than most anarchists really realize. And we've got to really kind of develop a base of support within those communities. And also those are communities that, like, action and, like, what you do goes so much farther than what you say. And I think that's where, you know, we can really shine, is just, you know, doing that work and engaging in those types of activities. I mean, like, you know, we brought up DSA, but, you know, one thing I'll say positive about them, I mean, there's a reason that people love the fucking, you know, Breaklight program, because it's, you know, real and tangible. You know, it's just like people went batshit crazy when anarchists in Portland filled potholes. You know, they were commenting on our Facebook page, like, you know, fix healthcare next, you know? So, I mean, that's what people want. They want, you know, real tangible stuff, you know? And I think that's where, you know, like, Alex Jones can't do that. You know, Richard Spencer isn't going to do that. None of those people are going to go out and, you know, do anything real and tangible in somebody's life. I mean, I think, you know, and the Democrats aren't. So I think that's where we can really shine. But Adam, did you want to say anything else to that point?
Yeah, like you were saying, you're giving some good examples of how people in build not just, I mean, I would say more than just a base of support. How do we get those folks, you know, organized and get them into groups that are independent of the, you know, institutional left kind of complex of NGOs? And that doesn't mean making them all anarchists explicitly, but moving in an anarchist direction, you know, swimming. You know, kind of in an anarchist current, so to speak, as far as the values, as far as how they're functioning, right? And I think the more that we can get people operating and doing along those lines, then the more that we're seeing the world.
Well, before we wrap it up, we're going to talk about what recently happened in L.A. There was a Rapid Response Network that responded to threat of ICE raids. Members of Black Rose are involved. Mm-hmm. I understand that you all have been able to talk to some of those people and are going to kind of give us a little bit of a rundown. So just tell us what's been going on in L.A. and what exactly happened over the last week.
First off, right now, immigration issues are hot, right, with Trump threatening to cancel DACA, canceling the temporary protected status for all kinds of immigrant groups, right? And also threatening raids on sanctuary cities across California, right? So people are feeling the heat around that. So in that context, there was the raids directed at 7-Eleven stores across the country. And people who formed this network, and I'll get into some of those the details, they were canvassing 7-Eleven stores in Koreatown, which is a neighborhood within Los Angeles, right? Working class, primarily immigrant neighborhood. And some of the workers said, well, hey, our store was raided. So ICE came to our store demanding documents, and they're going to come on a specific day later this week. And hey, we're open to your help and support around this, right? So that triggered their rapid response network to begin to mobilize. Also, for their own kind of selfish reasons, the manager contacted immigration nonprofits, and then that brought in unions and other groups mobilizing simultaneously, but separately around this. And they basically brought out a big crowd in front of this 7-Eleven holding signs, and that intimidated ICE, stopped what they were there to do. They still met with the manager, got those documents that they were looking for. But the critical thing to realize is that the purpose of the raids is not just to get whoever they're specifically looking for, but it's a form of public intimidation, right? And what often happens also, and we're seeing an increase of this, and, you know, this is what I'm hearing from LA comrades, is what they call collateral detentions, right, or collateral arrests, which means ICE goes into one workplace, it goes into one apartment building looking for a specific person, but anybody who opens their door that they bump into, they're going to request their documents, and they can grab them and pull them in as well, right? So keeping ICE out of the neighborhood has a real meaningful impact in keeping people safe and preventing them from being deported, right? And also just, you know, turning the tables and let's intimidate ICE and make them afraid to come into neighborhoods. So, yeah, I think it was a small, a small impact. Right. But I think it's a great example of, how we should be fighting Trump. Right. And also, I think in particular with this example that I think is kind of lends more. Makes it even more interesting. Right. Is that this rapid response network was actually formed out of a popular assembly in Koreatown, right? So earlier in 2020, nonprofits, they organized these community assemblies or called for community assemblies in different neighborhoods, right? And this happened in other cities as well. But they didn't have a real intention or purpose with them. So in all the neighborhoods where they happened, it basically fell apart. But specifically in Koreatown, where Black Rose, not just Black Rose, kind of political militants, you could say. So out of the assemblies that happened in the, there's kind of like a planning committee that meets in between the assemblies. That's where the discussion and the vote took place to say, we're going to form this rapid response network. So it's actually been in formation for a year from what I understand. And the, get this. I was pretty impressed with this, a 24-hour hotline, right? A cell phone. That's staffed by a team of 20 dispatchers. Take 2 to 3 4-hour shifts per week, right, to get someone on that 24 hours a day, right? They have it multilingual. They have people who can respond in English, Spanish, Tagalog, Korean, Bengali. The workers from 7-Eleven were actually Bengali. They have 90, I believe, trained first responders. So these are people who go through some trainings that they hold by regions of, based on where they live or work. And so work, figure out what's going on, report back, and try to mobilize other people if needed. So the scale of organization, I think, for these assemblies that were initiated by nonprofits, began to move in their own independent direction and are not controlled by or affiliated with a particular group. For them to take on this project and for it to be a just a activists who decided, hey, we think this is a great idea, but people from the community who said, this is what we want, and people came together and organized that. I think that that makes it even more powerful as far as an example of, you know, beating back ICE and Trump's, you know, white supremacist agenda, right, of deportations, and an example of building popular power from below.